Sangila.
Quay.
Why eat beef snack seal?
Tan she.
Tanet e. Negad dakote.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Tanashikia, hello and how are you? Sheila Rogers Dishani Kashun. Mi nom de famille, Celie Sinclair, Puli Christie, Simpson, Puli McTavish. Ottawa, Dos Jean, Kiamaka. Winnipeg, Ne Weekin. Ne kish kitain en michif. Welcome to Words and Culture, the Michif episodes. My name is Sheila Rogers. I'm originally from Ottawa in the unceded territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe. Kiamaka, how about you? I live in Winnipeg, Treaty 1 territory, and the homeland of the Red River Métis. I'm committing to learning, practicing, and supporting the preservation of Southern Michif, a language which is, to put it simplistically, a beautiful blending of French nouns and Cree verbs. But it's so much more. A living language of family, of trade, as we learned from Heather Souter in the first Michif episode, of ceremony, and of Michif life. Just a few weeks ago, the University of British Columbia released a research review of studies related to Indigenous languages and health. The main takeaway is that Indigenous people experience better health outcomes when they speak their traditional languages. And the languages, of course, will be healthier and stronger as more people learn them. I'll keep trying, making mistakes like I did at the beginning of the program, absolutely for sure. But I'm inspired to keep going by people like young Hugo Lussier, who we'll hear from in a moment. I will keep trying. Let me tell you a bit about today's guests. Originally, I was going to invite Dr. Danielle Lussier to Words and Culture to talk about Michif beadwork and language, and beadwork as language. Danielle is the inaugural chair in Indigenous Knowledge and Perspectives at Queen's University in Kingston. She's the first person in Canada, and maybe even the world, to deliver her PhD law thesis partly in beadwork. Danielle agreed to my invitation, but quickly told me the person we really had to hear from is her son, Hugo, who, unbeknownst to her, was learning Michif. Now, I know Hugo a little. He's 13, very engaged with the world, and passionate about all things Michif. And now, that includes the language. His reasons for wanting to learn Michif are very powerful, and he'll explain what's at the heart of his commitment and what we're about to hear. Welcome to my conversation with Dr. Danielle Lussier and her son, Hugo Lussier Meek.
So, Tanche Hugo Lussier Meek Dishnakashun, Ottawa Dushu, Niamachif Dili Rivière Rouge, Kukioli Territoire Anishinaabe et Haudenosaunee. That is in Michif, my traditional language, which I'm doing my best to reclaim at this point, that my name is Hugo Lussier Meek. I was born and raised in Ottawa and now Kingston, but I'm a Métis from the Red River. I'm 13 years old and just came out of 7th grade, where I run the beading circle for the school.
Merci. And Danielle, would you introduce yourself?
So my name is Danielle Lussier. I'm Hugo's mom. I'm also Rosalie and Opal's mom. They're at the park on this 35-degree day near the shores of Lake Ontario. I'm the reason that Hugo and his siblings are growing up as members of the diaspora. I was born and raised and have deep roots in Red River, but I've been in Ontario for almost 25 years. years having left to pursue university education programs that weren't available in Manitoba at the time. And now I hold a research chair at Queen's University. And that's why we live on Dish With One Spoon, Wampum Belt, Covenant Territory now. But we're very pleased to be here today with our relative, Sheila, and to talk to you a little bit about the amazing work that the young people are doing to push forward our intellectual self-determination and our sovereignty in new and beautiful ways that I couldn't have even imagined when I was in grade 7 in Winnipeg. We're not going to put a date to that because, of course, I'm ageless and timeless. But back to...
You transcend it all.
Thanks, Sheila. Thanks, Sheila.
Well, Hugo, you actually had me tearing up as you introduced yourself in the Michif language. Why is it so important to you to learn the language and then present yourself that way?
I feel like it's important to me for plenty of reasons, mostly because it's what my ancestors spoke. And, yeah, it's who I am, who we are. I feel like it, as said in Anton Treuer's book, the language helps us be more recognizable to our ancestors. So, yeah, I'm currently learning it through various websites put together by Norman Fleury, as well as the Manitoba Métis Federation, I believe. So, yeah, gradually learning it. I feel like it's important to present myself that way because it shows who I am right then and there, presents myself how I want to be presented to the world and how I want the world to see me as a young Michif person, yeah.
I'm interested in you saying you also want the ancestors to recognize you. Why is that important to you?
Because they're who I am, they're who I come from. They're who my children will be. And yeah, I feel like it's extremely important to become more connected with them, especially after the theft of our language. Yeah, I feel that it makes us more connected, as I said, yeah.
I'm crying.
So part of the struggle as an adult trying to reclaim language, you know, I frequently say that when I get to where I'm going and I get together with my ancestors, I better hope they like to count to 10 because there's not much else going. I'll be able to introduce myself and say hello, and we better be counting beads or beaver pelts or something because we're not going to be able to communicate. I was telling you before we started recording that I went to Hugo's school and his principal, who is a very lovely man named Monsieur Ali, said, "Oh, come, we need to show you something." And there was a video of Hugo, speaking really beautiful Michif, and I had no idea that this had been happening on the side, but also... I learned that Hugo had made some efforts to bring other Indigenous languages into that space. Hello, goodbye, thank you, in a few different Indigenous languages that are still spoken on the territory we're on or were previously spoken. And this is an interesting idea of acclimatizing non-Indigenous learners to these ideas that we are still here, that language ties us to both our ancestors mm-hmm. and the land, and all of these different ideas. So if we let the kids lead, I think we're okay.
Mm-hmm. So this was news to your mom, eh?
Yes, I suppose that it was.
I wonder how your childhood or your teenagehood years compare to Hugo's, Danielle.
I mean, they're fundamentally different. I grew up obviously surrounded. I was raised in a single parent household. My mom worked at Safeway, and she became injured on the job and found new space in universities when I was a teenager, but I was surrounded by my grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins and all kinds of folks. Whereas because of choices I've made, career paths I've decided to pursue, my children are growing up not necessarily in that context. We have trips home and we have email and all of this, but it's not the same as being able to kind of go hang out with your family at any given time. Nana moved here with us, so we're lucky to have access to Nana, and we've been able to build a really beautiful community of mostly other academic aunties around the university who are also raising their children away from home. But it's different from being grounded in community at home. So these are things that we navigate. You know, our kids carry our burdens. But, you know, in the case of Hugo and his sisters, they do it very well. And they're finding the soft spots and building their lives here. Members of the diaspora too, it's challenging because there's a lot of stuff going on around indigeneity, especially in learning contexts in universities. So they are at the front of that, and have to be clear about who they are as people, and the introductions are part of that. So you know who you are and where you come from and who claims you.
Right? Yeah. I want to ask you about a slightly different language, Hugo, and that would be the language of beads. And you're wearing some beadwork right now. Can you describe that for us?
On the left of my chest here, I have... This is actually the piece of beadwork that we made during Circle. We did it with...
At your school, yeah.
Yeah. We did it with various neon beads because that was the choice that I made while ordering them. Yeah. Also on my bolo, by my bolo tie here, we actually got it at the powwow yesterday,
oh, cool.
Or the day before.
In
yeah,
Toronto.
It has red dress quill work for Red Dress Day and IWG. It also has various other techniques such as flat bead work here with the two cut red and gold beads, as well as the edging, which I actually figured out. In larger silver ones. Yeah, I wear it around my neck. During the winter, I wear it every day. During the summer, less so, but yeah, t-shirts don't adapt so well to it.
And why is that important to you as well? I mean, it's another form of visibility, right?
I feel like it often prompts people to ask questions about who I am. Which is especially good because at school I don't exactly introduce myself every 3 seconds. Yeah, I feel like it's a good visual marker. Yet again, makes me more recognizable. Also, I just quite like the aesthetic and building it too.
And have you always been a bead worker? Did you grow up with beads?
Yeah. My mom learned when I was, I think, 7 or 8, 6. Pre-COVID, I learned at the start of COVID, gave lots of time for that. I was making mittens and bags at that point. Actually started an octopus bag a couple of years ago.
How's it going?
Slow.
Slowly, yeah, exactly.
They're a lot of work. They are a lot of work, but it's going to be beautiful when you're finished.
Indeed it will.
Yeah, it will. I know it will.
Yeah.
And did you grow up with beads and beadwork, Danielle?
No. So in our family, Nana was always a sewer. Her hands were always busy. And their hands are always busy, you know, the old ladies. My mom would say that she's not crafty. When she listens to this, she'll laugh at that. My auntie, though, is quite crafty. My mom says it skipped a generation. I remember my grandma teaching me, the basic. Knitting. I can only do a garter stitch and cast on and cast off because I'm left-handed. So it was very challenging for her to teach me. But there was always kind of sewing happening and different things happening, but not beads. So, as is the story with many, many folks, it was safer to not do that for a long period of time. It was safer to not adopt the aesthetic that you know, served as one of the foundational markers for ethnogenesis of the nation. So beads came to me later in life. You know, it was before COVID, but it was in like a quiet, kind of challenging time in my life.
Can you say how they came to you?
As visitors, you know, we can't harvest wherever we are. So I had gone to Beaded Dreams, which was a store owned by Kim and Morningstar on Bank Street in Ottawa. And I went to buy medicines because I couldn't harvest. And they had really good sage. And I knew it was harvested properly. So I went and there was this wall of beads and I just started filling a basket. And the rest, as they say, is history. I came home and I had all these beads and I didn't know what I was going to do. So my first project was an advent calendar for the children with 24 buckets and all of this. Designing as I go and learning the limits of beads, and then it morphed into something more. We always have beads around the table. Rosalie and Opal are also bead workers and embroidery artists, and I think having access to materials around you, the invitation to engage makes a big difference, which I think is one of the things that Hugo was thinking about standing up his beading circle at his school. It's an invitation to come and learn. In that case, it's an invitation to non-Indigenous folks to come and learn about him and with him. But around the kitchen table, you know, it's an interesting moment where we sit quietly and there's always someone with something on the go. And we've had a lot of help from very generous teachers who pop in and out, you know, with new techniques. We had stood up a beading circle at the University of Ottawa a few years ago, and that has kind of taken on a life of its own, and that's something that outlives us at Ottawa. But the spaces that it creates for women and children and men now is really, it can have a transformative effect on the energy in the room and our ability to visit and talk with one another. Do you agree?
I do, yes.
And is that it, or would you like to say more?
Yeah, I feel like, as you said, without living, that's the goal with my beading circle. The goal is that it becomes a permanent feature of the school long after I'm gone. Yeah, I also completely agree with the kitchen table part. Yeah, it really helps to have people around who can help you and teach you as you're doing it with them. Conversation's also nice too. And I feel like that's something that you get more in smaller beading circles and at home. I get somewhere between 3 and 9 people each time. 25 people have come out in total. It's quite wonderful.
I wonder if you're going to think about someday teaching the Michif language.
I have thought about it, yeah. First, I would have to learn it, but yeah.
Yeah, you like it's going to be part of your future for sure.
Yeah, I agree. In the end, I really hope that I'm able to teach it to my descendants.
How do you find learning it? Are there ways? Are there games? Are there things that stick more than other things? Other methods?
I find that it's rendered a fair bit easier by the fact that I speak French, because it has roots in both French and Cree. I learn it by translating individual keywords, and then just adds up eventually. I look into the sentences part to figure out how to build a sentence. I'm learning songs.
What songs are you learning?
I'm starting out with I'm Still Standing. Why? Because I came across a couple of keywords earlier, but yeah.
You don't have to sing it, but would you say it for us? Or you could sing it if you like.
I will say the couple of lines that I currently know.
Great.
Nianapawi kaipit apte tutoma itapi kam lisel survivor, because I can't remember that word, looking like a little kid. Nianapawi apte tutomata. Feels like I'm better off without you on my mind. Nianapawi, yeah. Nianapawi, yeah.
Sorry, the Elton John song?
Yes.
It's the Elton John song, which is hilarious because Nana will just faint. So to be clear for listeners, not a traditional song, not a song with ancestral knowledge, just a young person mobilizing language in a really interesting way. I'm still standing, Hugo.
I think that's so cool.
Yeah, I honestly just chose it because it's a song to which I know a couple lyrics. Yeah. I'm thinking next I'll do William Prince because there I actually know the whole song.
Yeah, the great singer from Pegwiz First Nation. Yeah, yeah,
he's amazing. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure he would be honored if you would. I think he'd be thrilled out of his hat.
Yeah, I also quite enjoy it because it's as much a class in music making as it is a class in language, which I also quite, it's what I like about it, as well as learning the language, of course.
Do you feel there's a music in the language itself?
I think so, based on what I've learned so far. I feel like I'll be able to give a better answer in a year or two. But yeah, I feel like it. I quite like the feel of the language itself.
Mm. How does it feel?
How does it feel? Lots of SHs and Ws, which I quite like the softer sounds, as well as the Ks.
Yeah.
Ks are fun.
Yeah. Yep, the Ks from the Cree, probably, right?
I would think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, is he inspiring on you on a language journey, Danielle?
I mean, I think there's the dream and then there's the ability and the resources and the time and the energy to be able to make the dream, you know, take action towards the dream. I have always struggled with language. I struggle with all the languages I speak, you know, thank heavens for spell check and grammar check and all of these things. I've struggled. When I make the joke that we're going to count to 10, in heaven, it's not really a joke. You know, I've always tried, but I really, really struggle. Mm-hmm. I think this is common for, you know, young mums. I think there's a lot going on and we feel a lot of pressure to do right by our kids, and then all of a sudden they're 13 and you're like, where did all the years go? I think it's incredible what he's doing. As I'm looking at him right now, I'm thinking, you know, it is a matter of priorities, so maybe this is an opportunity to make it a priority, you know, around the kitchen table, the same way we prioritize the beadwork and the moccasin making and the mitten making. So you got me thinking, Hugo. But I find language, it's intimidating. It's challenging as an adult learner. You know, I teach adults, and we can't even get a common vocabulary going in English a lot of the time. You know, we're speaking different languages. Even though we're speaking the same language, but yeah, maybe there's a soft spot here for us. Maybe he has to push me a little bit. You know, sometimes we find we're just trying to survive in these spaces, and there's not always room for the dreaming that is what's really necessary to transform the spaces. So sure, he's inspired me. We'll have to talk more about this later, I guess. I'm so intimidated. Hugo will drag me along.
I think it's really interesting that you've chosen, whether it was conscious or not, I'm still standing, because we're still here.
I would say that I did see the meaning, but I didn't choose it based on the meaning. I chose it because it was the song that was my earworm that day.
What a good worm.
And at least he's honest, you know. We talk about meaning making. Sometimes we'll create a piece of beadwork and we'll read the beads after the fact. You know, we can read things in. It's kind of like we're like the Supreme Court when it comes to legislation. We make the beads and then we add interpretations after. But I'm glad that you're honest. It was just what you had going that day. I mean, you come by it honest. Mom and Nana are huge Elton John fans, so there you go.
I want to say to both of you, Kichi, Marcy.
You're very welcome, and thank you. Yeah.
Merci, Sheila, for giving Hugo this opportunity. I think if we were to listen to the little ones more, not so little anymore, you know, he's a teenager now, but if we listen to the youth, I think that's how we're gonna, the youth and the elders together are gonna guide us in the right direction. The kids are all right.
Hugo Lucier Meek and his mother, Danielle Lucier. Hugo is a student at L'École Secondaire Publique Francophone Mille-Îles in Kingston. And Danielle is the inaugural chair in Indigenous Knowledge and Perspectives and teaches at Queen's University, also in Kingston. Danielle Lucier's beaming pride in the next generation and Hugo Lucier Meek's understanding that knowing the language helps us become more recognizable to our ancestors are so uplifting. They both make me want to keep practicing Machif, or to put it another way, making Machif a practice. Kichi Marcy to them both. I feel the future is in good hands and great hearts. The first time I ever heard Machif spoken fluently was at a Knowledge Keepers gathering put on by the wonderful members of the Métis Nation of Greater Victoria. This would have been about 10 years ago, and it took place at the University of Victoria. Elder Norman Fleury spoke about the origins of the Machif language as a God-given tongue. That was what his grandmother told him, and she only ever spoke to him in Machif. Norman is a tireless and outspoken advocate for Machif. He's done so much to keep the language strong, vital, and alive. If you visit the Gabriel Dumont Virtual Museum of History and Culture, you can go to Machif Words and Phrases. This is all online. And if you click on the little speaker icon, the voice you will hear is Norman Fleury's. I'm honored that he will be our guest on the finale of Words and Culture, the Machif episodes. Merci Machif Vieux, Norman Fleury. We'll talk to you next week. If you'd like to hear earlier Machif episodes or episodes about other Indigenous languages and cultures, check out our website at wordsandculture.ca. Or you can find Words and Culture wherever you get your favorite podcast. I'm Sheila Rogers. Kichi Marcy for listening. Talk with you next week. Kawapamatan Mina.
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Housing down King Sam.
Maltus.
Ninuis ahaha miku kwa kwal.
Kachu nautano.
Wapamatin mina.
This is Bird Note. We know that hawks and eagles have keen vision, and that owls can see in the dark. But what else do we know of the visual ability of birds? Well, most, like us, possess the ability to see color. Yet it also appears that some birds can do humans one better. They can see in the ultraviolet spectrum. Such birds can perceive colors that people can only dream of. Female budgies, the classic pet store parakeets, may choose mates based on how nicely their feathers reflect ultraviolet light. Hummingbirds likely zero in on certain flowers because their petals strongly reflect in the ultraviolet range. The waxy surfaces of many fruits reflect ultraviolet better than nearby leaves, which helps attract fruit-eating birds like these scarlet-fronted parakeets. And it's not just birds that can outsee humans into the ultraviolet range. Bees, butterflies, bats, and yes, probably even rats have got one up on us in the ultraviolet world. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. This episode is sponsored by Bird Conservancy of the Rockies. The world needs birds. To learn more about their work and mission, visit birdconservancy.org.
CJSF is 90.1 FM, broadcasting from the heights of Burnaby Mountain.